What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Welcome to my neighborhood, the Avenue. I grew up here, and each week I'll be sharing the sounds and stories of the people that made the Avenue great. Welcome back to the Avenue. We have some sad news to share this week. The great Indianapolis jazz trombonist Phil Renolin suffered a debilitating stroke. A GoFundMe page has recently been set up by Phil's family to help pay for his medical expenses. So to show our support for Phil during this difficult time, we're going to share an interview he recorded with WFYI's Kyle Long in 2018. Phil Renolin was born in Naptown on May the 25th of 1939. During his time in Indianapolis, Phil played with some of the city's greatest jazz legends, including Freddie Hubbard, Wes Montgomery, Dave Baker, Melvin Ryan, and Larry Ridley. During the 1960s, Phil left Indianapolis for Detroit, where he co-founded the Tribe Jazz Collective in 1972. The Tribe mixed music with activism, sharing their socially conscious messages through the Tribe record label and magazine. In 1977, Phil moved to Los Angeles, California, where he still lives today. And during his time out west, Phil cut four classic albums with his Arsenal Tech high school classmate, Freddie Hubbard. Phil remains a cutting-edge figure in music to this day, and his work has been remixed and reimagined by a whole new generation of artists. Let's start things off with a classic recording from Phil Renolin. From 1972, we'll hear How Do We End All of This Madness, featuring Phil Renolin on trombone and vocals.
We must unite with anger.
That was the legendary Naptown jazz trombonist Phil Renolin with How Do We End All of This Madness. Let's join WFYI's Kyle Long as he asked Phil Renolin about his early years growing up in Indianapolis.
Yeah, Mr. Renolin, I have a lot of guests on the show who attended Crispus Attucks. And we hear a lot about the educational music program at Crispus Attucks, but I know you're a graduate of Tech. You were attended school there around the same time as Freddie Hubbard.
Exactly.
What kind of program did they have there at the time? It must have been pretty good to have produced a couple great musicians like you guys.
You know what? They had special programs. I'm going to be quite honest. I was not in the real special. I wasn't in the jazz band. I was just in the marching band and orchestra, you know. But they did have a jazz band over there. From what I could tell, it wasn't hardcore jazz, you know, but they did have somewhat of a program. But back to Crispus Attucks, you know, I had the privilege of attending one of the summer sessions. I may have mentioned that before to you, but where Dr. Brown was, you know, was conducting. They used to have a summer, you know, you didn't have to be enrolled at Attucks to attend, because I tell you the truth, that's where I met Melvin Ryan and James Spalding, Larry Ridley, you know, and we were all, I was still in grade school, you know, and a couple years older than me. But anyway, that was real vital in the development of a lot of guys, you know, coming up, you know, during that time, yeah.
So there wasn't necessarily that sort of specialized music training going on at Tech that you could have tapped into, like they had the sophisticated program over there.
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah.
No.
So you received, I'm guessing, the majority of your instruction off campus. It wasn't so much related to what was happening at Tech.
Right. You know, I being honest again, I really didn't get serious until after high school, to tell you the truth. You know, like, although I heard JJ, you know, like, in high school, and it kind of was in my head, you know, like, you know, to pursue this, but I didn't really get pretty serious until a couple years later. Yeah.
What was your relationship with Freddie Hubbard like during your high school years? Were you guys, you were a year or two apart, right?
Right. Yeah, we were. We were, you know, like friends. We met, like, I think I was nine and he was like 10. And, you know, like we met in a situation where kids gathered together to play basketball. And so I'm going to straighten this story out because the story gets a little weird here. I've heard other versions of it, but what actually happened, I wasn't playing against his team. He just happened to have been there, you know, in the auditorium, in this, you know, what do you call it, where they play basketball?
The gym.
The gym. Yeah, he was in the gym hanging out, you know, and that's the way we first met like that. He was playing at the time, and I wasn't. You know, I picked up the horn a couple years after that. Yeah. And so then, fast forward, you know, like maybe two or three years later, we both were in the All-City Band. You know, we re-met again because I didn't really develop a real friendship with him until around the time when we re-met in the All-City Band, you know. Yeah, yeah.
And you mentioned it was after high school that you started seriously thinking about playing music. I know you found the J.J. Johnson record in the Tech band room. What other kind of circumstances had pushed you towards giving music more of your attention?
Well, my grandmother's collection, she had a vast collection, record collection. But it was... not only included jazz, it was like the whole gamut of black music during that period, you know, and from Big Maybelle and James Brown on up, you know, to Charlie Parker. So I heard a Miles Davis record at her house, you know, and man, I'm going back and forth because really that took place when I was still 9 or 10 years old, you know, but all these things kind of stick with you, whether you realize it or not. At least with me, it did, you know. And so finally, I decided, you know, I was going to get serious. And I hooked up with Dave Baker for a while, you know, and took some lessons with him. It's a calling that you have to answer if it's, you know, if it really hits you in, you know, in the right place, you know. I feel privileged to be a part of this great music, you know. It's, yeah.
And you mentioned studying with Baker. Mm-hmm. At that time, he was giving private lessons out of his home. Is that correct?
He was.
Yeah. And I've heard a lot of different guys studying with him, even like Randy Brecker.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I met the other Brecker that passed away. I'm going in. He's coming out.
Yeah. So you saw Michael coming out of Baker's house.
A lesson.
So what do you remember about those private lessons with Professor Baker?
They were pretty intense. I remember that I only had over a course of two and a half years, a total of maybe 10 lessons altogether, you know, because he was giving me a lot of information. And maybe I'm a slow learner because I had to go shed it, you know, and try to get it together before I go back for another lesson, man. 6 months might go back for at least 3 or 4 months, you know. Yeah, David was a good teacher, I think, yeah.
And at this point as a teenager, had you started playing in clubs already around Indianapolis? Where were you kind of honing your skills in the live setting?
Blues bands and, you know, playing dances, that sort of thing. My first actual gig, professional gig, was with Ermine Hubbard in a mental institution on Washington Street, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. When I, you know, was still in high school and everything. But, yeah, after that, I started playing with Harvey and the Blue. I was playing with a lot of blues bands, you know, and playing dances, like I mentioned, you know, and kind of try to keep my chops together. I did a lot of sitting in, you know, during that time. In all honesty, I didn't have a lot of gigs. When I was here in Indianapolis, I was only a band leader briefly, you know, like I, you know, played the 19th hole with my band a few times and, you know, but I didn't play a lot of clubs other than just going around the hubbub and playing with everybody that came through there pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, Harvey Cook just retired a couple months ago, Harvey. He'd been playing music here for about 60 years, and he decided he was going to retire from...
He's still around.
He's still around, and just retired from the live music scene. He'd been going for, I think, 60 years playing music here in Indianapolis.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah. What? So that was one of your early gigs, sitting in with Harvey. Any other blues?
Well, actually, I played I was playing with him, you know, in his band for a while.
And the gig you did with Ermine Hubbard, you said that was your first gig at the Central State Hospital. What kind of event would that have been?
They were having, you know, entertainment for the inmates, or what do you call the people in there? Yeah, you know. And the weird thing about it was, this is no exaggeration, no, it's honest God truth. My neighbor from about 3 or 4 doors down from me where I lived with my parents was in there at the time, you know, and so he was sitting right down front, you know, and he said, "Hey, Philip." So I knew one of the, you know, people there, you know. Thank you.
What neighborhood did you grow up in here in Indianapolis? Was there a specific neighborhood, or did you move around?
I grew up in the east side, called the neighborhood called Brightwood.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, on 24th and Oxford.
Yeah. I know at one time in the Brightwood and Martindale area, there were clubs. I think there was a club called the Savoy at one point in the 40s.
And the Savoy was right at 25th and Martindale.
Yeah, was that still going during your childhood, or had that?
Yeah, it was still happening.
Yeah. Were you seeing much music over there?
I never played in there. Yeah. I never played in the Savoy. Savoy was a pretty rough place, too.
Really?
Very rough place, man. By the time I was coming up, yeah.
I remember you told me you had a chance to play with Wes Montgomery at one point, or you sat in on a gig. Could you talk about meeting Wes and performing with him?
Man, that was real. That was like... combined with the idea of what JJ was doing on the horn and meeting Wes Montgomery. And I met Wes through Melvin Ryan, and it was just by chance, because as I mentioned before, by chance I met Melvin. I left my girlfriend's house over on the avenue, walked down. There was a famous shoe store that sold Stacy out. You know, back in the day, that's, you had to have, you know, if you was going to dress up, you had to have some Stacy Adams, you know. So I was going in the Stacy Adams store, and Melvin was coming out. And like I told you before, we had met in Dr. Brown's summer class. But we hadn't really, you know, interacted since then, to be honest, you know. But we kind of recognized each other, even though 2 or 3, maybe even 4 years had went by. We kind of looked at it and said, did I know you? Yeah. Play trombone. Oh, man, yeah. And so we reintroduced ourselves. He said, you know what? You still playing? I said, yeah. He said, man, I'm working with Melvin. I mean, I'm working with Wes Montgomery over at a place called The Hubbub. You working with Wes Montgomery, really? You know, because Wes was already a legend around here. So he said, man, you should come by. They're having a matinee today. I said, you mean to play? Yeah, bring you home. I'll introduce you to him. So you know, I went home and I went to the matinee, and I walked in, and I'm not sure if they had already started playing or they were just on break, but they weren't on the bandstand. They were on, you know, sitting in a booth, not a booth, a table, and the whole band, matter of fact, Paul Parker, Wes, and Melvin, and so. Melvin saw me walk in the door, and he kind of motioned to make sure I saw him. And I walked over, and he introduced me to Wes. He said, what you got in there? What's that? Oh, it's a trombone. He said, well, break it out. So as a result of that meeting, I ended up coming back on the, sitting in on the matinee for like 16 straight weeks, you know. And it still sticks out in my mind. It's one of the best music lessons you could ever want to get, you know.
Remind me how old you were during this time?
During that time when I met Wes, I was either 18 or 19. Yeah. Beautiful human being.
Red, I've never heard I've never known of another musician that people speak so highly of, both off and on stage, his demeanor off and on stage. People,
yeah, he was just a joyous kind of guy. I mean, you know, he's just, if you, you know, if you, even if you see footage of him, he's usually smiling about something or whatever. But he had a very positive attitude. And he encouraged me to continue on because I, you know, I was certainly learning on the job. You know? So, yeah, he tolerated me, you know. And man, what a great guy, man. I can still hear that sound.
You know, you're a great ambassador of the Indianapolis jazz scene. I know you often speak of the influence of this music on the genre and the importance of players out of Indianapolis. I'm curious at what point in your development you realized that there was something special about this city. Did you know that early on, or was that something you kind of came to the realization later on in your life?
A little of both, I believe, because it was apparent, you know, like Indianapolis, it's not, you know, the size of Detroit or Philadelphia or any of those other cities that produce a lot of great guys. Relatively small. I mean, you know, like when I was coming up, it was less than a million, you know, I think 800,000 or 900,000 or something like that. So, I always just say this, you know, like name three top guys on their respective instruments. And I mean, you look at JJ, you look at Wes Montgomery, and you look at Freddie Hubbard. I mean, so that's a great start. I mean, you know, like, and so many other guys too, you know. And you have Slide Hampton and James Spalding, you know, and Ridley and all those guys coming up. So that's not a school of Indianapolis school of jazz per se, but it was, you know, it was definite, man, I mean, there was some great guys around here that they all had their own sound, you know. Yeah.
Is that something you can kind of hear in your own playing, that Indianapolis
well,
sound?
I think I have my own sound, yeah. Too, whether it's, you know, for good or bad, but I mean, it's, I think it's through self-development. Has a lot to do with that, you know, because I literally watch Freddie develop. I mean, it's like there was one period where he just took off, and he was doing so much playing, you know, not long after he left Indianapolis, because that's really when he got it together. He had, you know, all the foundation here, but by the time he got to New York and had a chance to play with everybody, so many people, you know, on a daily basis, and playing in lofts all day long, and going out after that and playing a gig, and going over to John Coltrane's house and practicing with him, then going over to Sonny Rollins' house and practicing with him. And so, you know, he's getting the best of all everything around. So, man, he really took off around 63, 64, and yeah.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. On this week's show, we're looking back at a 2018 interview WFYI's Cal Long recorded with Phil Renolin, a legendary Naptown jazz trombonist. Let's listen to a track from Phil that references his time in Indianapolis. From 2005, this is Phil Renolin with Naptown Afternoon. ¶¶ Stay tuned. Echoes of Indiana Avenue will return with more words and music from Phil Renolin after this short break. This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. On this week's show, we're featuring an hour of words and music from the legendary Neptown jazz trombonist Phil Renolin. Sadly, Phil recently suffered a debilitating stroke, and his family has organized a GoFundMe page to help pay for his medical expenses. To show our support for Phil during this difficult time, we're sharing an interview he recorded with WFYI's Kyle Long in 2018. Let's return to our conversation with Phil as he recalls leaving Neptown for Detroit during the 1960s.
I remember you told me that kind of your ticket out at Indianapolis, was it a gig with the Temptations? Am I right about that?
Almost.
Almost, okay.
What happened was I met there was a band that was performing at the Hubbub, right? And like I mentioned, I had made it a habit to go by there and just, the matinee, you know, it was open mic, you might call it, and pretty much you could just sit in, right? So I was, you know, just didn't know who was playing there. I just happened to go there one Saturday, and this band from Detroit was there. And the leader's name was Sam Sanders. And so I played the whole matinee pretty much with him. And so at the end of the matinee, he said, "Hey, man, I really like the way you sound, man. Are you busy around here in Indianapolis?" I said, "Nah, not really, you know." He said, "Well, if you ever decide to leave here, and you know, Detroit's not that far, you know, say I'm hooked up with Motown. I can get some instant work." So, I mean, he could have just been talking off the top of his head, but he wasn't, you know. So, and I guess I gambled, but I won on that one, you know. I'm thinking as he's talking to me, I'm thinking, "Well, my sister's there. I got a place I can stay for a while until I can get on my feet, you know." 2 weeks later, man, boom, I'm in Detroit. So, and immediately I called him up, you know, I called him because he said, "Give me a call if you get here," you know. So I called him up. Just so happened they were rehearsing for a tour with the Temptations, you know, for a 10-day tour. Motown seemed to do a lot of 10-day tours, you know, especially regionally, you know. So after the rehearsal, I think maybe a week went by, and then we went out on the road for 10 days. And I think I told you this before, but the very first stop was Indianapolis, Indiana. And so it was quite ironic, you know, but yeah.
Was your exit from Indianapolis in any way motivated by a frustration here that you weren't kind of getting enough work, or you weren't finding like-minded musicians to work with, or was it just a new opportunity you wanted to try in Detroit?
Well, new opportunity, because in Detroit I could be a full-time musician. You know, here in Indianapolis, Wes Montgomery worked a day job, you know. So, I was working for my dad, you know, helping him with his business. I kind of almost feel like I was deserted. He depended on me a lot, you know, but at some point you kind of have to go with your heart. And, you know, I explained to him that I wanted to pursue music pretty much. And, you know, Detroit, man, I was playing with 6 different bands in Detroit.
You mentioned you were working for a time with your father. What business was your father in?
Oh, he had a concrete plant. Yeah. 22nd and Ralston.
And I did want to give you an opportunity to talk about your involvement with the Tribe Collective in Detroit. I think that's one of the most unique and important movements in jazz history from my perspective. What you did in terms of not just being a record label, but being active activists in the community and kind of uniting your activism with music and with the publication of a magazine.
Yeah. For us, it was like one and the same in a sense. You know, like we were doing the music and, trying to bring the people. You know, Detroit was kind of depressed at that time because the uprising was still kind of, what year? It had been 3 or 4 years. But anyway, it was still like people were looking for something to build on. So Tribe come along at a time where we're able to actually provide work for people too through the, you know, the magazine and the record label, you know. So, and the record label, in a sense, ended up being a producer's alliance, because everyone on the label, they had to really fund their own project, you know, because we weren't really a label per se. I mean, we're just kind of like an umbrella, you know, for people that creative, you know, had some good music that wanted to, didn't have an outlet for the music. We were there, you know, so I think, it's funny, but that label didn't really take off until after we had disbanded, you know. And the first time I found out that we had records that were collector's items was probably in the 90s, you know. Yeah. And I was in L.A. at the time, and a store owner, a record store owner, approached me, you know, and said, hey Phil, hey man, you still got some copies of that joint that you put out called Vice and the Tribe? I got a few. He said, man, they're worth a lot of money now. I said, really? He said, yeah. So, yeah, but it, you know, like Tribe presented a lot of pride for people that were in the community, you know.
Before you went to Detroit, had you kind of been in that scene at all in terms of political activism in Indianapolis? I can't remember exactly what year you told me you left, but I know there was a guy, Snooky Hendrix, and the Black Radical Action Project.
I knew Snooky.
Yeah. Were you involved with any of those guys?
Them. I was aware of Snooky. I knew Snooky. Yeah. I never was involved with that. I just, in my head, you know, like I was between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, I guess, because I knew things weren't right, you know. And so I was trying to learn as much as I could about how to do my part of, escalating the people, you know. And so through the music, I guess that's what I attempted to do, raise the awareness, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned that the music and the activism, everything was kind of the same to you at that time. How did that manifest? Like, I know you told me you presented Angela Davis a copy of your record at a rally. Were you guys out playing at rallies? Were you getting involved beyond just the kind of performers?
We were, and I feel really very privileged, very blessed that I was able to actually do that, you know. But yeah, we were doing those sort of things, and we did a lot of free concerts too, you know. It wasn't always about the money, you know. Of course, we needed money, you know, but when there was opportunity to do something to, you know, for a cause, we tried to do it, you know. I was also involved in a group, knowing you, you probably heard of this, the Grill Galaxy. Those guys were like, most everybody in the band pretty much was a Muslim except me, you know. But they were just, they were beyond tribe. I mean, you know, they rarely had a gig that paid any money, but they would go play for free everywhere, you know. I use those guys, some of those guys on my record, Vibes from the Tribe, on one side, you know.
I wouldn't describe what you were doing as like free jazz or it was a little experimental, but what were you listening to at that time, or what was kind of going on that was influencing the music you were making during that period?
During that particular period, I was listening a lot to John Coltrane and Archie Shepp and those people. Basically, yeah, during that period, that's who I was really listening to. And so, also, I have to admit, Motown had a big influence on me because they had some great writer, arrangers, and I was playing those arrangements, and that had a big influence on me, too. So, I like to think that I kind of combined some of that.
Sort of the funk elements with the spiritual side of Coltrane.
And the bebop aspect of Charlie Parker and J.J. Johnson. And
you mentioned that the whole tribe movement didn't really start to get recognition until the 1990s. But mm-hmm. I'm curious, at the time, what was the kind of impact of the music in the community? Were people interested in what you were doing? Were you getting a good response at the concerts?
It was a mixed reaction. Some, you know, really loved it, and then some were, what are these guys? But we used to play a place in Ann Arbor, it was a famous place at the time called the Blind Pig. And that place was, we could play our music. We didn't have to, no holds barred. I mean, we could go present. And they were, you know, the college, you know, right on the college campus, you know. So we look forward to that, you know.
Did you tour at all outside of Michigan at that time with any of the guys with Tribe?
Very seldom. I think the furthest we probably got was Wilberforce, you know, in Ohio. Yeah. That was it.
And you cut your first records with Tribe as a solo artist, right? I'm curious what your family back home in Indianapolis thought of the work you were doing at that time. Were they interested in it? Was it too avant-garde for them? What kind of response would you get from the family and friends back in Indy? Do you remember?
You're pulling it out of me, Cal. My grandfather said, I need to have a talk with you. He never said why, but that's what he said.
Just wasn't their cup of tea, probably, right? From your time with Tribe musically or politically sticks with you today? Is there still part of that in what you do today?
Oh, sure, of course, yeah. You know, it'll always be there, part of me, you know. And I truly value my time in Detroit, you know, because that really was the point where I was really started developing and started I had started writing right before I left, you know, but I really had a chance to hear some of the stuff I was writing over there, more so than here, you know. Yeah, and I'm still in touch with Wendell Harrison is still around, you know. We lost Marcus Belgrave a couple years ago. But the nucleus of the whole thing was like myself, Wendell, Marcus, and Harold McKinney, you know. Detroit was culturally rich. It really was. Yeah.
And Mr. Ranlin, you mentioned in the 90s is when this interest started to develop in the tribe material. What do you make of that, the ongoing interest
well,
in this label?
The young people.
Yeah. What do you think they're finding in this music year after year that still
they find it a powerful? Spirit. They find it sincerity, and they find it, you know, like the music sometimes, you know, it has to not necessarily be technically perfect all the time for people to gravitate to it and feel it. You know, music is a communication of the heart, you know, and soul. So people recognize it when they hear it, you know, so that's what, you know, I think that's what keeps it, that music alive, you know, and the young people seem to grab a hold of it. It appeals to young people.
I think it was about 10 years ago they did this remix project where a lot of your songs were remixed by pretty substantial electronic and hip-hop music producers. Mm-hmm. What did you make of the results of that? How did you feel about it?
Artistically, I was happy with it. It didn't go very, I mean, it didn't go anywhere as far as, you know, sales or anything too much, but I was happy with the outcome. I didn't know what to expect, you know, because to me, you know, I didn't know what remix was, you know. You know, I think they did a good job. Yeah.
What projects do you have coming up or anything you're working on now that you want to share with people?
I'm really trying to get to the point of dealing with some old tapes that I have. I mean, it's some great music, man. I got some, you know, when I first moved to L.A., I formed a quartet with, at the time, the hottest trio in town, which consisted of Billy Childs, Tony Dumas, and Ralph Penland on drums, you know. So I was doing some quartet things, and we had some great live performances. You know, I would like to hopefully put it out sometime, you know. And also, there's a couple of them that have Kent Brinkley, the Indianapolis bass player, on it, you know.
Finally, I'm just curious how you feel. You come back to Indiana once every couple years and do a show. What's it mean to you to come back here and play? Is it a meaningful concert for you when you come back home and play?
Well, I'm kind of keeping in touch because I do still have so much family here, you know. And so when I come back, it's gratifying in more ways than one, you know, musically and through spiritually and, you know, getting a chance to see my family again, you know. Being on the West Coast is, I don't get back here too often unless I am playing. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, man, for taking time to speak with me today. I sincerely appreciate your time. And, man, I'm such a huge fan of all the work you've done, and it's always an honor to have a few minutes to speak with you, man. Really appreciate it.
My hometown, a beautiful feeling arises within. A constant memory of times that bring joy to a proud father's heart so sincere. Two
girls are by that I love just the same. Two girls are by to me, a thrill they bring. I fall in love each time that I hold them and feel all the warmth that children bring.
We've been looking back at a 2018 conversation between the Naptown jazz legend Phil Ranelin and WFYI's Kyle Long. Sadly, Phil recently suffered a debilitating stroke. If you'd like to help donate to Phil's medical expenses, his family has started a GoFundMe page to raise money. You can find more information on the Echoes of Indiana Avenue Facebook page. We'll end this week's show with Living in a New Day from the 2008 album Tribe. And this track features Phil Ranelin on vocals and trombone.
'Cause this is how we all feel. We know that war is not the answer. War is not the answer. 'Cause it's sick just like a cancer. Love is the way. And we will find it one day, one day, one day, one day.
You can meet me here on the Avenue again next week, same time, same place. And you can find the Echoes of Indiana Avenue podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcasts. Echoes of Indiana Avenue is written and produced by Kyle Long and hosted and co-produced by me, Herman Butch Slaughter.